You are listening to a sermon by Carl Friesen, recorded on Sunday, November 14, 2021, at Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you for also for inviting me to share with you today. Carolyn and me very fondly remember our time at PGIMF, both in formal contexts of church services and also informal conversations and meals shared together. So it's a real pleasure for me to be with you again today, even if only through the mediation of a computer screen. So as was mentioned, what I want to talk about today touches on some of the themes of my dissertation, although really only kind of begins to scratch the surface of one corner of it. But so I think it's become almost quotidian or even mundane to rehearse in a lot of circles, to rehearse the whole litany of ecological ills that seem to plague us at every turn. So from climate change to soil erosion, from litter-filled oceans to polluted streams, from severe droughts to unprecedented wildfires, from food shortages to skyrocketing food prices, and of course, a global pandemic, we're ever aware of our precarious position in the natural world. And I think increasingly so, it's just become part of the way that we think about the world around us. Or perhaps more accurately, I think we've become hyper aware of what is wrong and yet are strangely paralyzed by the scale of it all. Many of us live our lives with a strange and uncomfortable tension between fear of imminent disaster on the one hand and a really strong sense of moral obligation on the other. And it's not exactly clear what we are to do, but we know we must do something. We must act. That's all we seem to know. And for Christians, the biblical exhortation to care for the earth or to tend to it, to steward God's creation, is the impetus for our sense of obligation. So scripture opens with this beautiful mythic narrative about God bringing order out of chaos, of a beautiful, peaceful world, emerging out of the darkness of the abyss. And as was just read for us in Genesis, we are then told that God created the world as a good garden, that God created the world out of love, and then God commanded humans to tend to the garden or to keep it, as some translations put it. So immediately from the very beginning of scripture, we capture the first glimpse into who we are as humans and how we are to be in the world. Creation is good, nature is good. Humans did not create the world, but rather received it as a gift from God and are now to steward or care for this divine gift. And these themes have also become very common refrain for many churches, and rightly so. They form the basis for a Christian understanding of what it means to be human and to live well in the world. They are stories I think we should continue to rehearse to one another in our daily lives, and they give the biblical narrative and Christian life a kind of earthiness or this worldliness that has been sorely lacking for much of Christian history, and alas, is still lacking in many churches today. Although I do think it is becoming more common and taken for granted that this is part of the Christian story. But these themes taken on their own also have a kind of abstractness to them. They seem to slip out of our grasp the moment we attempt to get our hands on them. So on their own, they do not really move us out of our paralysis or give us any indication of what we should do. Affirming that God created our world, that God loves our world, and that we have an obligation to care for it may rule out wanton destruction of nature or treating nature as a mere instrument for our own human needs and wants. It rules those things out. And that indeed is something. That is not nothing. That's not negligible. But in order to meet our overlapping ecological crises, what is needed to both identify our failures and motivate us to action, I think, is a more theologically, aesthetically, and scientifically robust understanding of creation, and the human role within it. The purpose then is not to dispose of the theological themes that I already mentioned. That's not the goal, is to not get rid of them or to even move beyond them per se, but to deepen and shape them through theological reflection, through aesthetic appreciation, what we might call contemplation, and through scientific insight into a more, what I want to think of as a more coherent picture of God's purposes for God's creation. And if we have that bigger picture in view, we have hopefully a more coherent understanding of ourselves within that bigger picture as a part of that bigger narrative. And I know this is a somewhat audacious undertaking for a short address, but I'll attempt to do it nonetheless, of course, only in a very elementary way. But I'll focus on three themes to accomplish this, hopefully. So the first is membership, the second is wisdom, and the third is presence. So membership, wisdom, and presence. So first, membership. So even in my earlier brief description of creation and stewardship, my description relied on an understanding of human beings as kind of self-contained entities, perhaps even as self-contained entities who stand over against or above the rest of creation. And in many Christian circles, stewardship is often interpreted in these terms, right? In terms of almost like a management hierarchy, and humans are at the top of the hierarchy. And the view is often that there's this fundamental divide between humans and the rest of nature. And humans are put in charge of creation. We are almost like the CEOs, albeit usually the encouragement is that we should be better CEOs. We should be more benevolent and gentle than our current way of doing things. But the general idea is that we are self-contained individuals who stand over against or above the rest of nature. And my suggestion is that there are lots of problems with this view. The first is that there's a kind of obvious hubris to it. The belief that we actually have the capacity to understand and intelligently manage complex and dynamic interrelated natural systems seems to me very hubristic. And I think we have ample evidence that precisely that view of human beings has led us down this road. So that's the obvious hubris, but I'll leave that to the side for now. It also problematically reinforces the idea that we are self-subsistent creatures who simply require resources to survive. So in other words, the view is that we are these isolated individuals, or what the philosopher Leibniz called monads. So we're these isolated monads who consume our environment for our survival. And even the word environment gets at this, right? This assumes this fundamental divide between humans and the environment around them. But that simply isn't an accurate picture of our reality at all. We are not self-subsistent creatures, and we are not separable from one another or from the natural world around us. We are members of the natural world ourselves, and are inseparable from it. We are but one creature among others, members of a vast network of relationships. You could think of it as we are members of the land. So this is where the membership theme comes from. We are members of the land, or members of creation ourselves. So this is evident even in the creation stories of Genesis themselves, right? Genesis 1 and 2, the two creation stories, the membership theme is often underappreciated. So in those stories, humans are given this special vocation to tend to God's creation, but they still remain creatures alongside the rest of the creatures. So humans continue to belong to the community of creatures in the garden, as it were. So even here, we get a sense that the most basic divide in the cosmos, when God creates the world, when God creates the cosmos, the most basic divide, what philosophers or theologians would call the ontological divide, right? The basic divide in reality is not between humans and the rest of nature, but rather between all of creation, with humans as part of it, and God. God is the creator of an interrelated, thoroughly interdependent creation. And then humans are called to responsibly participate in creation as members of it, as one more creature among others. So there's kind of the biblical, just the start of a biblical case for something like membership. But then the British scientist, he's an anthropologist named Tim Ingold, suggests that we need to go even much further than this. Rather than thinking of ourselves as simply entangled in a network of relationships, it's not just that we're members, it's more accurate to understand ourselves as what he would say is we're constituted by our relationships. So in other words, we are not more or less self-subsisting individuals who then choose to be embedded in relationships, but rather we to be a living thing is by definition to be in a network of relationships. So I'll repeat that. To be a living thing is by definition to be in a network of relationships. You can't be alive without being in a network of relationships. We are who we are only because of the way that we relate to other creatures. So an obvious example of this is eating. When we eat another living thing, whether it be a plant or an animal, we do not simply make contact with it. We take it literally, we take it inside of ourselves. We digest it, we incorporate it into our own body. So the theologian at Duke, Norman Wirspa, suggests that we actually think of eating as becoming one flesh with another creature. So there's almost this marriage quality to it when we eat. So the other creature doesn't stand apart from us, but nurtures us. It re-energizes and refreshes and revitalizes us from inside of us. So when we stop to realize that this is not, that this act of taking other creatures inside of us, and eating is just one example, breathing, touching, it happens in diverse ways. But when we stop to realize that this is not just a human thing, that all living things, in fact, do this, this becomes all the more staggering to consider, and you begin to realize how thoroughly incorporated into the land around us or the natural world around us we are. So every living creature, no matter how big or small, if microscopic or an apex predator, must consume and be consumed in order to live. We are always already both host for other creatures and being hosted by others. The whole process of life is sustained through these infinitely complex interactions. And this is why some scientists now suggest that we need to replace our understanding of organisms to kind of move past that idea that the world is comprised of distinct organisms and rather think of something like the idea of a holobiont. The word is holobiont, which is an admittedly very clumsy word, but it's been developed to emphasize the idea that no living creature is ever a self-enclosed system, but is always in intimate relationship with others. And without these relations, we cease to exist, essentially. Even more strongly, without these relations, we never would have come to be in the first place, because life emerges out of these kinds of symbiotic relations, not just between people, but between all sorts of diverse species. To acknowledge this is to see that living things are always already communities of creatures. So we are not individual organisms as much as we are holobionts. We are our own little community of creatures interacting with other communities of creatures. And this kind of worldview shift has pretty vast implications, I think, both moral and theological. So it implies, for example, that God did not create a bunch of random beautiful things, but rather that God created the world to generate new life through complex natural processes and patterns of relationships. So the late theologian James Gustafson calls this the patterns and processes of interdependence. So in other words, God's creation is always teeming with life. God calls forth new life through these dynamic processes and patterns of relationships that have to be sustained in order for life to be sustained. God creates and sustains creation through these symbiotic natural patterns and processes of relationships. And I think the passage from Psalm 104 begins to capture this interdependence, right? Describing this kind of beautiful ecological whole, or a whole system where God provides for each creature on its own terms, so that they each have this kind of niche in this bigger whole. But they end up being thoroughly interdependent. And so we might say that to participate well in God's creation is to participate in forms of life or patterns of living that have their orientation in God's own caring ways for the world. That's what the beginning of what it might mean to be human is to participate well in ways that are kind of similar to or analogous to God's own caring ways for the world. So how do we do that? This leads to the second point, which I described as wisdom. And what I mean is that on the view I'm describing, there's divine wisdom. God's wisdom is evident in the very ordering of God's creation, in the different ways the communities of relations I'm talking about are arranged and sustained. So we are always already a part of a community of creatures, as I mentioned, but the ordering of those relationships matter, like how they are ordered between each other. So if we want to live well or live rightly as members of God's creation, then we must recognize our interdependence with each other, with the rest of creation, and to work to sustain healthful relationships or healthful communities of exchange or communities that foster life. So instead of thinking of our relationship to nature, again, in terms of extracting resources to sustain our own lives, we suddenly begin to shift our thinking toward thinking of ourselves as part of this dynamic whole that operates in many ways through cyclical processes and complex interrelationships. So we must arrange our lives then to reflect patterns of relationships and forms of interdependence that allow the diverse members of our communities, whether human or not, to be whole. In a word, our aim or our vocation in this view is health, by which I mean wholeness. And those of you familiar with Wendell Berry's work will recognize his influence here. This requires to think of the health of a whole community requires a very complex set of considerations, right? There's a lot of things we have to try to account for because we always have to think about whole systems. We can't just think about individual pieces or whole communities and their complex forms of interaction. But the point is that the way nature evolves and sustains itself over a time gives us some insight into what that might look like. So we can mimic or foster natural patterns and processes that generate new life. And so this requires us to ask questions about sustainability, about limits, something we rarely want to talk about in our tech-obsessed age, about what are limits, human limits, about the well-being of all members of a community. So we ask questions like, how can our communities be indefinitely sustainable, be powered by sunshine, have no waste? How can we farm and garden in ways that foster biodiversity rather than single species? How do we farm or garden in ways that do not rely on synthetic inputs in order to maintain fertility? How do we maintain a healthy biology with a broader healthy biome? How do we build cities that are good for overall health? And these are the kinds of questions that are prompted by the view of creation I am proposing. And my suggestion is that we can look at natural patterns and processes for insight. And I don't mean to oversimplify this. There's a great deal of room for debate about what that might look like in practice, in the way that we configure our lives, in the way that we plan our cities, in the way we grow our food, in the way we approach healthcare, and so on. But I think it requires a shift in focus to this more robust understanding of ourselves, our relationship to the rest of creation, and our vocation. In order to describe this probably better than I can, I'll read a short excerpt from a poem by Wendell Berry. The poem is simply called Healing. The grace that is the health of creatures can only be held in common. In healing, the scattered members come together. In health, the flesh is graced, the holy enters the world. The task of healing is to respect oneself as a creature, no more and no less. A creature is not a creator and cannot be. There is only one creation, and we are its members. To be creative is only to have health, to keep oneself fully alive in the creation, to keep the creation fully alive in oneself, to see the creation anew, to welcome one's part in it anew. The most creative works are all strategies of this health, works of pride by self-called creators. With their premium on originality, reduce the creation to novelty, the faint surprises of minds incapable of wonder. Pursuing originality, the would-be creator works alone. In loneliness, one assumes a responsibility for oneself that one cannot fulfill. Novelty is a new kind of loneliness. There is the bad work of pride. There is also the bad work of despair, done poorly out of the failure of hope or vision. Despair is the too little of responsibility, as pride is the too much. The shoddy work of despair, the pointless work of pride, equally betray creation. They are wastes of life. For despair, there is no forgiveness, and for pride, none. Who in loneliness can forgive? Good work finds the way between pride and despair. It graces with health. It heals with grace. It preserves the given so that it remains a gift. By it, we lose loneliness. We clasp the hands of those who go before us and the hands of those who come after us. We enter the little circle of each other's arms and the larger circle of lovers whose hands are joined in a dance, and the larger circle of all creatures passing in and out of life, who move also in a dance, to a music so subtle and vast that no ear hears it except in fragments. That last part leads well into my final short point. Passing in and out of life, moving in a dance to a music so subtle and vast that no ear can hear it except in fragments. So this idea that we learn to, there's these patterns or this rhythm or beat to the natural world. And of course we can use science to study it, but we have to learn to walk in step with that beat, but it's not a blaring loud beat. It's something we have to become attuned to and sensitive to, which leads to my final point, which is presence. And I won't dwell on this point at any length for the sake of time, but my point is simply that I think our technologically mediated existence has compromised our ability to see beauty and wonder and a sense of God's presence in creation. Even those of us who care deeply about our ecological crisis, who are sensitive to creation, our way of being in the world, have still been captivated by the constant bombarding of information on our attention. we've been conditioned to divert our attention to flashy artifacts and information at every waking moment. And there's this kind of disorienting effect to all of this. But more fundamentally, it takes away from our health in the sense mentioned above. We are not whole. We are not attuned to the way that our actions impact those around us. And then we miss seeing God's presence in God's creation. So I think we need to relearn to see creation for what it is, to pay attention to creation for what it is, to see God's life and light in the life around us. And I'm reminded of the American writer Annie Dillard's Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. For those of you who have not read Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, I highly recommend it. It's a very good book. As many of you know, Annie Dillard was in her mid-20s and kind of escaped to the forest in a Thoreau-like manner to kind of recalibrate her life and to think and to almost have a monastic experience. And then she came up with Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. So I'll read just a short excerpt from that to end here. So she says, "The secret of seeing is the pearl of great price. If I thought he could teach me to find it and keep it forever, I would stagger barefoot across 100 deserts after any lunatic at all. But although the pearl may be found, it may not be sought. The literature of illumination reveals this above all. Although it comes to those who wait for it, it is always, even to the most practiced and adept, a gift and a total surprise. I return from one walk knowing where the killdeer nests in the field by the creek and the hour the laurel blooms. I return from the same walk a day later, scarcely knowing my own name. Litanies hum in my ears. My tongue flaps in my mouth. I cannot cause light. The most I can do is try to put myself in the path of its beam. It is possible in deep space to sail on solar wind. Light, be it particle or wave, has force. You rig a giant sail and go. The secret of seeing is to sail on solar wind. Hone and spread your spirit till you yourself are a sail, wetted, translucent, broadside to the merest puff." When her doctor took her bandages off and led her into the garden, the girl who was no longer blind saw the tree with the lights in it. "It was for this tree I searched through the peach orchards of summer, in the forests of fall and down winter and spring for years. Then one day I was walking along Tinker Creek thinking of nothing at all and saw the tree with the lights in it. I saw the backyard cedar where the mourning dove's roots charged and transfigured, each cell buzzing with flame. I stood on the grass with the lights in it, grass that was holy fire, utterly focused and utterly dreamed. It was like seeing, it was less like seeing than like being for the first time seen, knocked breathless by a powerful glance. The flood of fire abated, but I'm still spending the power. Gradually, the lights went out in the cedar, the colors died, the cells unflamed and disappeared. I was still ringing. I had been my whole life a bell and never knew it until at that moment I was lifted and struck. I have since only very rarely seen the tree with the lights in it. The vision comes and goes, but I live for it, for the moment when the mountains open and a new light roars in spate through the crack and the mountains slam." So, my suggestion is that through cultivating these habits of attentiveness and learning to walk in rhythm with the natural patterns and processes of nature and understanding ourselves as part of this community of creatures, we can develop a more theologically robust understanding of what it means to be a human in an age of ecological crisis, and hopefully cultivate a renewed appreciation for what it means to carefully and sensitively and lovingly participate in God's creation as members. Thank you.